There's one more opposition factor, and that's in some of the newspapers. The New York Times. Did you have trouble with New York Times and Adolph Bax?
Adolph who?
Adolph B. I can't read my own writing. B A C K S. Bax.
Who was he supposed Backer? To be?
I guess he was a writer or an editor on the New York Times. And was bitterly opposed to suffrage.
Yes, I think the New York Times was opposed. I don't recall it was ever for us.
And there was a newspaper in Louisville that was opposed. But
I think a great many people, I don't think we had much support from the press.
Oh, you didn't?
No.
Well, what I've been reading the quotes from newspapers that did support you. So I think that might give a kind of a skewed impression of the support you get from the press by reading through the suffragists and...
You see the... when you say the Post, you mean New York Evening Post?
No, I said the Louisville paper, and I don't know which one.
Oh, Louisville
paper. It's Watterson's paper, and I don't know which one Watterson had. We'd have to look that up.
Well...
But I wonder if you remember.
As a whole... We had this wonderful person who did all the press work for us and kept all the clippings and so on. We have the clippings down there, a great many of them in Washington, one could go through and see. But my impression was we weren't getting much support from the press. I know that we got support from a few, and we always recognized it and knew who they were. And one of them was a paper up in Boston, which was edited by Mr. Gruning, you know, Senator Gruning.
Mm-hmm.
You know who he is?
Yes.
Well, did he die by any chance?
Alaska?
Yes.
Yeah.
Do you know whether he died?
It seems to me he did.
Because in the middle of this election campaign, you know, he was the chief speaker for McGovern, his number one speaker. And his wife is a member of our national board, Dorothy Greening. And he went all over the United States speaking for Greening, speaking for McGovern. And then I heard over the television one day, during the midst of the campaign, that he was very, very, very ill and not knowing whether he would recover. And I never heard a thing about his death, so I didn't know whether he survived or not. But anyway, Senator Greening told me the other day himself that in looking through the papers for his memoirs, which he's writing, was writing in, up in his own house I was that day, and he told me this himself. He said that he had found a letter from me as national chairman of the Women's Party to him, thanking him for the great help he had given in the winning the vote for women. And he said he'd kept it all these years. He's putting it in his memoirs. Well, there were individual cases of where people did go all out and help us.
Mm-hmm.
When we were picketing up in Boston, when the women were arrested on Boston Common, all these times he came to our aid.
Do you have these clippings in a scrapbook?
We have volumes of them.
Where?
In the National Women's Party headquarters.
Oh, they're not in the Library of Congress.
No. And I hope they're not. And Mrs. Belmont, when she became interested in this campaign, before she became interested in ours and joined us, when she first became interested in suffrage in general and was financial contributor to the National American Suffrage Association, she bought a house on the corner of 41st Street in New York City and Fifth Avenue. I don't know the exact corner, but just right there, that neighborhood, a whole building. And she established a society called the Political Equality Association. And she made herself the president. And she started in to try to work in any way she could. And then when the National American practically threw us out, you know, when they told us to resign and apply for a membership in another form, she was their principal financial backer. So she withdrew from them completely. In great indignation, and joined us.
Oh, so that's why she entered the scene right then. I wondered what
and she had
caused her to do that.
we'd gone to see her and gotten her interested a little bit, and she approved of everything we were doing. And then she was outraged when the National American acted this way toward us. So it was in the spring of 1914, when we were at our lowest ebb, she joined us. And she'd already bought this house, and she had on the ground floor a little office. Later on, she gave this office to us. It was the New York City office of the National Woman's Party.
Oh.
And she went, you know, on our board after about a year. So in her office, she employed a girl, a Jewish girl, to search all the papers in the country that she could search, and any article about votes for women, to paste in her scrapbooks. They're about this thick, and there are, I don't know how many volumes, on several shelves of them. So I imagine that and all these people writing books come down, they always go through these press clippings.
Are those also at the Belmont House?
Yes, they're there. And I hope when you go down, you'll go in and see all these things. And I'm pretty much worried. I'm very worried because we have a new chairman, and I think she's well-meaning, but I don't think she knows very much about the campaign, or is it all the type of the women who built the organization up? She was in the Bureau of Internal Revenue and for years, and then she had some rather subordinate position there. Now she's resigned from the Bureau of Internal Revenue and come down and taken our biggest room in the headquarters that no chairman's ever taken before, and filled it with her own possessions, and just taken over the whole headquarters and all the money and everything else. And to my great alarm, just before I came up, she came to me and she said, "I've made the most wonderful arrangement. I've gotten $10,000 for the Woman's Party. And you know what I've done? I'm giving them all the records of the Woman's Party. And they've agreed to put their whole staff of girls that's sorting all our records and our filing cases and so on, and putting them all in the Congressional Library as a gift to the library." And I said, "But you haven't any right to do that. Great part of those letters are my personal letters that I've written over the country hither and yon, and Mrs. Emma Guffrey Miller has written a great many of these letters, and you know who she was, don't you?"
Yes.
And Mrs. Florence Byard Hillis has written a great many of them. These were volumes and volumes and volumes of letters here in these filing cases. And without the consent of these women, you haven't any right to do this. And I said that all kinds of personal letters are mixed in there, and it would be a great violation of the understanding on which these people came and wrote their letters here for us. But I don't know that I stopped her. I'm not sure. And I'm so terribly afraid that I'm going to learn that. And she makes everything seem very plausible. So, Mrs. Butler Franklin, do you know her?
Yeah.
Well, she's our first vice chairman. And she's an extremely fine woman, a very fine woman. And she's a second cousin of Mrs. Belmont, and is out in Virginia, close to Washington, and comes in quite often. Well, she called me up and she said, "We're going to have a board meeting, and on the subject is what to do with all the Woman's Party documents." And I said to her just what I'm saying to you, "Well, these must not be given away, and I think it would be absolutely dishonest to do such a thing. And when the whole campaign is over, we ought to do as we did when the whole suffrage campaign is over, put some very responsible person in charge of sorting the papers and discarding what should be discarded and classifying them, cataloging them, and then giving what we feel we want to give to the Congressional Library, but not just turn over to these a dozen young colored girls what they have now, almost nothing else in the Congressional Library, who come in harem scarum, and no matter what we find in the Congressional Library, be a terrible, terrible, terrible thing." So I was going to say, if you get a chance to impress upon this Mrs. Chitty, if in case any papers are left, the sacred duty that we have to preserve them and not give them out to the world by people who know nothing about their value mm-hmm. and what should be said and not said.
Mm-hmm. Well, something like that needs to be gone over by someone inside the party first, I guess.
Yes, but if they get over to the Congressional Library and these colored girls start, they'll send everything down and it's going to be in the manuscript department. I remember when a man, I think maybe I told you this, a man came in to see me who's writing The Life of Jeanette Rankin. Did I tell you about that?
Oh.
And he came across a letter from Mrs. Catt.
Oh, yes.
Well, we don't want that sort of thing to happen.
Yeah.
If Mrs. Miller's written a letter to somebody saying, well, I think Miss Vernon is not a very competent person or something, she never would write such a letter, but I mean, supposing something like that, such injurious letters might happen to be there by chance. I think it's a dreadful thing.
Well, my experience there last week was that nothing is available to anybody, at least right now.
Well, if it's all over the
Congressional Library. I couldn't even look at a copy of Irwin's book.
Of what?
I wasn't even allowed to look at a copy of Irwin's book.
Of what?
Irwin's book.
Well, maybe she didn't have one to show you.
Yeah, she had several.
Well, why wouldn't she let you look at it?
Because she has no facilities to handle people like me who come in wanting to see a copy of The Suffragists or a copy of a book. And I explained to her that I couldn't bring all these things from Berkeley with me up here.
Did you tell her you were coming up here?
No, I told her I was going to talk to Mabel Vernon, which is what I was about to do at that time. And,
Well, that's absolutely outrageous.
But there was just no way that I could come and use anything.
Well,
I don't think anything's available right now, at least, and I don't know.
Well, I'm so afraid that it's all over in the Congressional Library. I'm so terribly afraid of it.
Well,
anyway,
does she want to move that entire library over to the Congressional Library?
No, she wants to take all these filing cases, like my filing cases up here.
Oh.
I brought a few up with me, which are my own letters.
Yeah.
I should have, if I'd known what sort of a person she was, I would have brought them all up. Well, I had a chance. I had a mover bring them up. It was very expensive to do it, but when I got this idea that she was going to put them over in the Congressional Library and have them start and sort and analyze and see mm-hmm. what they'd keep and so on, I was horrified. But all my expressions of anxiety didn't seem to have the slightest effect upon her. And then I thought it had. I didn't think they would do it. And I got this telephone up here from Mrs. Butler Franklin, the first vice chairman, and she said, this subject is coming up, and would you tell me what you think we ought to do about it? And I told her. And so then she called me after the meeting and she said, well, it was voted to have a committee, and the chairman of the committee is somebody that has never been in our movement.
Oh, this and must be that. She said to me that there was some professor who was going to take over the handling of the history and get a grant to do the to catalog everything in the library. That's what she told me. Maybe that's this person who's head of the committee, do you think?
I don't know, but this was a woman, and she said, Ms. Franklin said, and Mrs. Chittick seemed to have everything in hand and to know just what ought to be done, and she said this was a wonderful arrangement she had made with the Congressional Library, and I'm sure you'll think so too. Well, I couldn't have thought so less, but I didn't know what I could do way up here when the meeting was over and they'd voted it. Put it in the hands of this unknown woman. And totally unknown, I don't know anything about her.
Oh, really?
She was chairman of the committee to dispose of all our records. All our tremendous effort through all these years is to be...
Well, I hope she doesn't dispose of anything that's valuable.
Well, she disposes of all your records. That is very valuable. Everything, she says, is now in the hands of this woman. So I hesitate to go down there. I don't want to have a blow-up over it.
And, what had you given to the Library of Congress before? I remember going through quite a few
I told you what we'd given.
Boxes there.
At the end of the suffrage campaign, I told you this Miss Mary Philbrook, a lawyer, and a member of the Daughters of the American Revolution, and very used to doing research, and one of our own members. found it in New Jersey, where she was the one who opened the bar to women in New Jersey when she was a young girl, about 19. And she studied law in her father's office and then wanted to practice and discovered that no woman could practice in New Jersey. So she went down, this young girl, and single-handed got the bill through to open the bar to women in New Jersey. And she's always been a very good, wonderful feminist. And she died recently, too. At the end of this last World War, whenever it was that the Depression came, before the war or after the war,
before the
money
war.
Came.
Yeah.
Whenever it was.
While you were in Europe.
She told me that she couldn't really continue to practice in New Jersey because the Italians had taken over all northern New Jersey, and they had the Italian judges, Italian court officials, and she said that an American woman, pushes all the prejudice against a woman, and there's a prejudice against an American, and she said, I can't get any case because the people trust me, but they know that when I go into the court, I'll have the court against me, against them, and so she said, I just can't get any cases. And so she said she was going to apply, if we approved, for a grant from this WPA, I think the thing was called.
Oh, yeah.
To catalog all the records of the suffrage campaign. Well, we were very happy, because I knew she would be absolutely perfect person. Reliable and conscientious, thorough, and knowing everything about, as much as I knew about the campaign, she would know everything. She'd know what to be preserved and what to be discarded and how to classify and so on. So she got the grant herself. She went forth and did it. And the grant was for 2 years, if I remember rightly. This may not be correct, but it's my impression. And she was to employ as big a staff as she could get on this amount of money they gave her. And I think, again, I may be mistaken the number, but I think she employed 12 women. And she took the whole responsibility. And we took one room in our headquarters. And they covered it with, Mr. Philbrook had it wired all over with chicken wire so that nobody could possibly get in there to disturb their work, to run off with any papers or anything. And there, for about 2 years, she worked and she had this staff. And she directed the whole thing and she saw exactly what they did. And then when it was finished, we had an exhibit over in that great big lobby, you know, in the front of the Congressional Library, up when you walk the steps, that great big room.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we had an exhibit of photographs from the beginning to the end of the suffrage campaign and of everything that was made a good showing in the exhibit.
Mm-hmm.
And everything was labeled by one of our members who was a librarian. It was a very impressive exhibit, I thought. So then the Congressional Library asked if we would give our whole, all our archives that Ms. Philbrook had gathered together of the suffrage campaign to the Congressional Library. And we said that we would loan them and would be grateful if they would protect them because we didn't have any paid librarian and we didn't have any fireproof building and we didn't feel we were as well equipped as they were. So they said, all right, they would take it as a loan. And every year, they send us a letter saying, would we like to convert it into a gift? And we always say, no. We think we ought to keep title to these possessions. And we do. And that we hope someday we can have a headquarters in which they could be taken care of with a professional staff and so on. And we've had very good relationships with the library. Well, now, building on that good relationship, she's apparently trying to dispose of all the rest that we have, just turn it over to them, not turn it over to somebody who could do it for us. And I wish very much, but I can't do anything with her, that Mabel Vernon could be gotten to take a little responsibility. We put her on this national board, and while I'm up here, she could do everything that I know she knows and could do so well. But is she too ill to do anything?
Well, it's hard for Mabel to get around.
But I know, but when she does get around, can't she, I can't see how she can let Mrs. Chittick do these terrible things. How she could let
Mabel could do a lot by telephone, I think.
Or she could go up in a taxi.
Yeah.
Consuela always takes her everywhere and helps her downstairs into a taxi and helps her get up over at our headquarters. And when I came up, that's why it was always that she came up quite often, and but she couldn't have come without Consuela.
Yeah. Well, and I think the main problem is just the...
But I never could get Mabel to... I don't know why, whether she's gotten too fatigued or too bored by it, or I say, won't you do this? This is such a crisis, and so on. Just as I would have, if I'd been in Washington, I certainly would have done something about seeing that you got this material.
Yeah.
And I can't see why she wouldn't do those things. And she's on the board and can cast the vote.
Well, she sees it as a very big problem.
As what?
She sees it as a very big problem, and that's all I know. But maybe if you called her...
She sees what as a problem?
Well, Miss Chittick.
I thought she was supporting Mrs. Chittick in every way. She certainly was when I was down there.
Well, I don't know.
Of course, she doesn't like it. Nobody else does either. She doesn't like to get in any fight with anybody, but she's in a position, really, to save our records.
Maybe if you called Mabel, it would help.
I had planned to go, down to Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And then I planned to go on to Washington.
Yeah.
And then I thought, when I discovered I'd have to pay $20 a day to go into a hotel, and I was afraid Mrs. Chittick wouldn't allow me to go into headquarters, and I thought, well, I'll spend a lot of money, and in that short time, I can't help Consuela with my main purpose in going.
Mm-hmm.
I need more time, I was afraid, to help her. But I think maybe this will do what
I
she wants.
So. Yeah, I think it will.
I don't know what to make of Mrs. Chitty. I really don't know what to make of her.